You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
Now, they're saying I should think stuff like this. They're saying
something is wrong with me.
To be so cynical.
Practice.
The 80s were a time of scientific wonderment. Space Shuttle Columbia flew its first mission. Mount St. Helens erupted. Apple makes its first personal computer while Microsoft released the Windows operating system. Compact discs made their debut in time for an electronics wunderkind to blind the audience with science. Oh, 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 oh. I remember that song. I want to take me to Funky Town. Want to take me to Funky Town. Did that band record any other song? What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more. Wonder what else is on that album. Wonder what other songs of theirs are good. Wonder why only one hit.
That's right, it's that time of the month again. Time for questioning, not everything this time, just wondering why certain...
Good save.
Good, certain artists are known as one-hit wonders. We are looking, you know, we ask you every month to pick, we give you a week to choose a song that you want us to, you know, I was thinking about it, especially with this one. This is like, we give this poll out there, and then do people actually vote for the song that they want to know more about? Or do they pick like the worst song that they know we have to listen to the album multiple times?
That wasn't the case this month, I think, because they picked the best song.
Yeah, I mean, we have been fortunate that they have not given us a terrible album to listen to yet.
Yeah. What were our choices last month, Chad? Do you remember?
Our choices last month... let's try this again. Our choices last month, from the 70s, we had Wild Cherry with Play That Funky Music. Yeah, they were dancing and singing and moving to the moving. And just when it hit me, somebody turned around and shouted, play that fucking music, white boy. Play that fucking music, right. Play that fucking music, white boy. Lay down the boogie and play that funky music till you die. From the 80s, we had Thomas Dolby, She Blinded Me with Science.
Science!
From the 90s, we had, I don't know his name.
Oh, Ine Kamosi.
Ine Kamosi, Idia Menzel, Here Comes the Hot Stepper. Here comes the hot stepper, I'm the lyrical gangster, big up the crew in the area, still have you like that. No, no, we don't die, yes, we multiply. Yes. And, you know, as fate would have it, once again, for the third month in a row, an 80s song won. So we're actually, next month, we are going to just go straight from the 90s. You'll have to stick around for those choices at the end of the episode. But, you know, as much as I love the 80s, and I know you're a big fan of the 80s.
Absolutely.
We want to spread the wealth around. We want to kind of go in a different direction. So, but this month, yes, Thomas Dolby, not Panasonic, not Magnavox, but Thomas Dolby. And I'm just getting that in there because I know some information that you're going to be giving us later concerning lawsuits and such. Yeah. Thomas Dolby, She Blinded Me with Science. And I have a confession to make before we start this one. this is not one of my go-to 80s songs. I am not a huge fan of the song. Not that I don't like it. I just, if I made a top 50 81 hit wonders, this would be, if it's on the top 50, it would be in the low end.
Wow. I mean, I think I remember it from the kitschiness of the video, and I remember just that science, you know, and I'm glad that this won, just because I was kind of curious, because Wes, we're going to discover throughout this episode, Thomas Dolby is a fascinating guy, and listening to it again kind of reminded me, like, the song is actually a lot better than I remember, and I know it's kind of funny to think, because you figure, oh, I've heard it so many times, but it's like giving it a newfound appreciation because of the fact that, like, when we did the other two, we did Safety Dance and Greatest American Hero, we were looking at how the song fit into the context of the album, whereas this was a single. Like, he had already released his album, and then this came out as a single, hit big, and then they re-released the album with the single tacked onto it. So it wasn't really supposed to fit how it fits into an album. It's just, you just look at it as a single. And what I found really fascinating about it, and I guess I can say it right off the bat, is listening to it again multiple times, listening to it with headphones, there, I don't know if you noticed, there's a lot of layers of this song. It's really complex. It's really interesting. And I see, and watching all the different variations of the live versions and stuff, and the different ways that he performs it, where he can do it with multiple people, he can do it with just himself. It's a pretty fascinating song.
Interesting. No, I listened to the album a few times, and with the headphones on, my first thought of the album, and we'll get more into this, I'm kind of jumping ahead, is I was listening to it at work, so it was more like background noise, and to me it was the album was very flat. It just seemed like one song. It could have been one 40-minute song. Mm-hmm. This could have been a Pink Floyd or an Arcade Fire or something like that, where it was just a fish. Like, this just seemed like a jam, because I couldn't tell you separately what the songs were. But the night before we record this, I actually did pull up the lyrics for the album and listen to each song individually, and it gave me a better appreciation for the album.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah, it seems like what I've been reading is, like, a lot of his lyrics were about World War II and just about architecture. Like, he wasn't writing love songs or anything like that, right?
No, and I think that's, we'll start now with just talking kind of about Thomas Dolby. Is one of the things about him is he never set out to be a mainstream success.
Oh, no.
The few interviews that I read with him said that, you know, he was more into the niche music, the cult music, or, you know, what would have technically been alternative in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't a fan of punk.
Yeah.
Was just kind of, I a lot of I listened to several interviews with him. First one was, he did the WTF podcast with Marc Maron. He did it in June of 2013. And so, thankfully, they archived those old ones on YouTube. So I listened to that. Dad was an archaeology professor. Mom was a math teacher. He was the sixth of six children. So he said by the time they got to the sixth kid, the parenting was done.
Yeah.
They just basically let him do his own thing. They had already, you know, his parents didn't push him into the academic world. He always thought he was going to end up there. He had gone to boarding school, and he actually left school when he was 16 to go work in a fruit and vegetable shop. And he said, because he figured his dad was like, if you're gonna fail on your own, if you will, and then you can eventually come back to the academics field. He couldn't really play any instruments at first. You know, he sang in a choir, and then when he got into the electronic music, that's when the sort of new wave was happening. Punk was going away, and then one of the biggest influences on him was Brian Eno, who was working with Roxy Music. He had worked with David Bowie in Berlin, and so all this sort of ambient music with electronic stuff. And so, like I said, he was in primary school, and he said boarding school, and he had gotten to where he would actually, like, find old circuit boards in the trash and solder them together to try to piece his instruments to try to put something together that he could play. And then eventually, he said that one of the first synthesizers that he ever had was actually a lighting sequencer from, I'm not sure if you ever heard of the band Tangerine Dream. They did the score for, I think, Legend, Ridley Scott's Legend, okay, and a couple other movies. And so they had this device that basically was designed where it would sequence the lights for their stage show. And so he got it. They were done with it. He got it. And he reprogrammed it to play music. And so he said, actually, the drums from She Blinded Me With Science were actually made off of this machine that was designed to do to sequence lights for a stage show.
Yeah, I think this is probably one of the most fascinating things about him, is the fact that he's not taking your standard guitar, keyboard, drums and putting together. He's creating, and I find it interesting, too, that the album title is, I forget the first word.
Golden Age of Wireless?
Golden Age of Wireless, which, you know, in 1983, how many people knew what wireless would it be? Whereas now, mm-hmm. you know, it's obviously a very, you know, modern term that everybody knows, but 30 years ago, 35 years ago.
As we're going to discover in the course of this podcast, he was a man who was trying to be ahead of his time, you know.
Or is he a time traveler?
Something like that.
Yeah. But no, I just find it interesting that he was creating his own devices, if you will, to create mm-hmm. his unique sound.
Yeah. And because he was all about just experimenting and trying new things and sort of like, if you're going to, I think it's there's that expression about like, you can't succeed without failing several times or whatnot. So I'll go back real quick. We'll go back with a little bit of the backstory. I mean, from there, like he's bombing around in England and just kind of getting to know people in the local music scene, and then he records a demo cassette. Starts putting together a lot of sounds with his synthesizers. He records a demo cassette and he gives it to I think it was Zomba Publishing to try to get a record deal with them, or at least a publishing deal with them. One of the people who ran Zomba Publishing was Mutt Lange, and so Mutt had heard it, and then that sort of parlayed into 1981. Mutt Lange was doing Foreigner's album 4, and two of the band members of Foreigner, Ian McDonald and Al Greenwood, who were played keyboards and bass, I think, they left the band. They both left Foreigner before the album was recorded, so they needed to have some session musicians to replace them. And so Mutt Lange, you know, he'd heard the Dolby cassette, or he'd heard Dolby's demo cassette, I should say, and he suggested to Mick Jones of Foreigner, hey, we should hire this guy. So basically what had happened was Foreigner was huge. They had all this money to make this album, and they were past their deadline, over budget, but the band would record during the day. They would do all the vocal tracks for Mick Graham, and then when they were done at night, Thomas would come in. They would lock him in let him go into the studio overnight, and they had all this money, so they gave him any synthesizer he wanted to use ever, and they said, just basically augment the sounds a little bit, add some make the guitars a little heavier, use some synthesizers. So he would stay in all night and then leave in the morning when the band came in, and he basically did that for an entire month. And so he had heard some of the stuff that David Bowie had done in Berlin with Brian Eno, and so he combined a lot of this ambient synth noise together, and then that ended up being the opening of Waiting for a Girl Like You. There's like a 15, 20 second just kind of an ambient noise intro. And he played it for the band, and the band thought it was kind of odd, but they still went with it. And then I found out later that when we listened to the Golden Age of Wireless album, there's one of the songs on there is called Urges, which was, I think it was a demo he had kind of been working on before when he was, I might've been part of his demo cassette. And so Mutt Lange actually liked on the chorus, he says, Urges. And so Foreigner had this song that they had written, and they didn't have the chorus yet. They had the verses, and then they said, "What about Urgent?" And so they put Urgent. If you know the Foreigner song Urgent, it has this keyboard line to it. That's Thomas Dolby. And so they got done with their month of recording, and they sent him home. They gave him an envelope with $7,500 in cash, and then just basically said, here, we're done with you. And he goes back home, and he basically used that finish off the album that he was working on, the Golden Age of Wireless.
Yeah, I saw the Mutt Lange connection, you know, came across that in my research, and I know Mutt from the work they did, I believe, with Def Leppard. I believe he did Hysteria.
And Pyromania.
And Pyromania. And then, obviously, in the early 90s, he married country star Shania Twain. Mm-hmm. But I did not realize that his work predated Def Leppard, I guess.
Yeah. But didn't he do Back in Black by AC/DC?
He may have. Yeah.
And what's interesting, I mean, Thomas Dolby actually is on Pyromania and Hysteria, especially Pyromania. And he said, what's funny is, by the time Pyromania had come out, he was a little bit bigger. Shabani with Science had dropped. So he wanted to distinguish his work with Mutt from his solo work. Mm-hmm. And so they used a pseudonym. The pseudonym he used was Booker T. Boffin, which I found out later. Boffin means a person engaged, the definition is a person engaged in scientific or technical research. Or another definition is a person with knowledge or a skill considered to be complex, arcane, and difficult. So he's Booker T. Boffin. So he said that, I read an interview with him where he said that when Mutt was doing Pyromania, he said this is the quote, it was a very manicured sound for a rock record, and a lot of what Mutt wanted me to do was to double the guitars and make them creamier and thicker. So he always jokes about, like, he's got these platinum records on his wall from Def Leppard that are say Booker T. Boffin on them. That was the name that he was credited with on those albums.
Interesting. So, I mean, that kind of shows there that, I don't want to say the nerd culture of Thomas Dolby, because I don't want to sound insulting, but the fact that someone would use such a obscure word to take for a name, you know?
Sure, sure. And then the one last thing I got before we get into, you know, Shabani with Science, because around the same time, I don't know if you saw this, he produced and co-wrote a song called Magic's Wand from the rapper Houdini's self-titled debut album. The song actually reached number 11 on the dance club song charts and number 45 on the hot R&B hip-hop chart. And it was one of the first million-selling rap singles. And I listened to it. It sounds like a Thomas Dolby song. It's got heavy synthesizer and it just has Houdini rapping and stuff. But it's so funny how you can tell. That's got his touch.
See, a rap attack means DJ's jamming in the street. MC's rapping to the beat. The people downstairs say they can't sleep. Cause the people upstairs are stomping their feet. It's not like they're starting to riot. They'll call the cops because we want some quiet. There's no need for them to get excited. They're just mad because they're not invited.
Because he produced it and co-wrote the song, so I'm sure maybe they had heard the demo as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your research, did you find, was Blinding Me with Science the first single, or was there a single release before that?
From Golden Age of Wild? Yeah, there was actually, well, at least, there was essentially like five different singles that came out of that album, all released over in the UK, and nothing really came, nothing was, one of the biggest ones was a song called Europa and the Pirate Twins, which, that song's not bad. I thought it was all right. There was, my favorite song on the album, other than She Blinded Me With Science, was a song called Airwaves, it's just a beautiful song, and that was released as a single. You know, none of these, like I said, they definitely didn't chart in America. I think they may have charted over in the UK.
Strange how the sky forms in tiny patterns. On my antenna and the 5 o'clock sharp alarm. Brooklyn is crawling.
The album was just 9 songs, and like I said, he basically did it all himself, because he took all the money that he had gotten from the advance from his publishing deal, and then the money that he made from working with Foreigner, and just kind of threw it together and then shopped it around from there. And then it was after that. That he had the idea for She Blinded Me with Science. And I don't know if you saw this or not, but he storyboarded the video first, and before he'd finished writing the song.
Right, yeah, he came up with the video concept and then wrote a song to kind of go along with the video.
And then directed the video.
Yeah.
You know, and he was saying how, like, he was one of the, he keeps talking about how lucky he was that, you always hear stories about artists in that era that they all wanted to get a record deal, or they wanted to get out of their record deal. And he said he had so much leeway with the company, they didn't ask for any notes. He was able to do everything he wanted. He could design the album covers. He could do all he could direct the videos. He had so much artistic control. And he kind of mentions that. He wrote a memoir in 2016 called The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. And he said supposedly on the first draft of the memoir, the publisher read it and said he came off as kind of bitter. And the editor had worked on a lot of other music books from musicians from that era and said, you're actually one of the lucky ones compared to all the other musicians from that era that got screwed. And so when they went back into the second draft of the book, he kind of edited it to sort of show that he was actually fortunate.
That's a good point, because here we are discussing, you know, why he's a one-hit wonder. Then you wonder, does that perception, you know, if, and I guess this is the difference between him and another artist, is here's a guy who wasn't looking to be famous, so to speak, but he is very much in that niche of one-hit wonder, whereas another band who was trying to be bigger, if they got saddled with just the one hit, where, you know, what, 20 years down the road, what is your perception of your career? You know, do you consider yourself lucky? Do you consider yourself a failure? Do you consider, you know, I have no answer for this because I'm not going to speak on his behalf, but it's just an interesting thing to look back if at someone who's writing about their career. We're like, you know, are you fortunate enough that you had that one hit? Mm-hmm. And even still to this day, a popular song that I'm sure he's still collecting royalties on.
Oh, sure. And so, it's interesting, like you said, because how many of these people get into the music industry to be famous and then, like, they have that hit and then they just spend the rest of their lives trying to replace it, try to have another hit and prove that they're more than just a one-hit wonder. Whereas he just was just an artist. He put out this album on his own, and then She Blinded Me With Science pretty much came out of this, just this idea that he had. He had gotten really into music videos, and so he basically viewed them as a silent film with a soundtrack, and so he came up with the idea for this song. Again, he didn't really care about making a hit out of it. He just wanted to have this idea for a video, and he kind of went from there, and then he just was just like, he can keep producing music, and, you know, he kind of gets into, I mean, I haven't read the memoir, I'd love to, but he, from what I've been told, at least from the interviews with him, part of the memoir, he talks a lot about the seedy side of the music industry and how difficult it was, and how he to this day now, he raves about how it's so much easier now. You know, most people think about how, oh, it's so difficult to get into music, and he said, no, now is the best time, he said, because now you can record something in your bedroom and put it up on YouTube, and, you know, you can get around record labels, whereas back in his day, he had to make a demo tape, he had to get it into the hands of an A&R guy, they had to like it, then they had to pass it on to an next person, and he said there were so many different levels.
Yeah, because, I mean, looking at it today, and I hope I have this information correct, I'm kind of going out of my wheelhouse, but I believe Chance the Rapper didn't have a label.
He still has never released an album on a label. Yeah, he's all done it by himself. Everything he's done has been mixtapes and digital distribution only, from as far as I gather.
Yeah, and I believe Charlie XCX is kind of the same way. She just released a couple. Nice. You'll be seeing her in a couple months when she opens for Taylor Swift.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, okay, yeah. And he and Thomas Dolby even referenced Jesse J himself. Mm-hmm. And he was showing Jesse J's. I watched a presentation that he had done, and he showed a clip of Jesse J doing a YouTube video. And he was like, a couple months later, she's on BBC performing in, you know, live studio audience kind of thing.
Yeah, so if you are talented, and or, well, in this day and age, even if you're not talented, but you know how to use YouTube and a video camera, you can have a career. But let's get back to why we're here. She Blinded Me With Science. As you said, it was a song that came after an idea for a video. Mm-hmm. And it came, and it just happened to be the one hit that popped out of this album. And let's go into, if I can pull up the right information, we'll go into what we do here. Every episode is break down the charts. See where, you know, where it debuted, how fast it climbed, how, where it stayed, and what its competition was at that time.
Okay.
She Blinded Me With Science broke into the top 100 the week of February 19th, 1983.
Oh, wow.
Do you know where you were the week of February 19th, 1983?
Well, I mean, I know I was living in the suburbs of Chicago as a, you know, would have been in like first or second grade at that time. But February of 83, okay. Because the song came out in 82, but I guess it took, you know, it takes a little bit of time for it to
momentum.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it debuted at number 77.
Okay.
Okay. And then it did not crack the top 40 until a month later, the week of March 19th. Now, these were the other nine songs, because it broke into the top 40 at number 36.
36, okay.
So number 40, we have So Close by Diana Ross. No. 39, Burning Heart by Vandenberg.
Okay.
38, Winds of Change. Not by the Scorpions.
Oh, really?
By Jefferson Starship.
Oh, yeah, okay, okay.
Yeah, Winds of Change, Scorpions would have been 89.
Yeah. Sure, yeah, yeah.
37, Little Red Corvette.
Okay.
36, She Blinded Me With Science. 35, On the Loose by Saga.
Saga, yeah.
I know that song.
Yeah, if you've heard that song, Chad. And when you hear that song, you think it's Loverboy. No one can stop. That's one of the ones that whenever I've heard that song, I always you mistakenly will think it's Loverboy.
You know, segue here. I think on a future episode, we'll just need to pull out obscure songs that were, and I'm air quoting, hits by bands that have been lost in time, but we may know. So we'll keep that in mind for a future episode. Anyway, 34, Your Love Is Driving Me Crazy.
Ooh, by Sammy Hagar?
By Sammy Hagar.
That's a great song.
I'm not familiar with that one. But I wonder, was your love driving 55?
Because he couldn't.
He couldn't. 33 is Past the Duchy? Duchy?
Don't tell me. Musical club.
Musical Youth.
Musical Youth, yes.
Musical Youth.
Okay.
32, Lies by the Thompson Twins.
Oh, Thompson Twins, who work with Thomas Dolby quite often.
And then number 31 was My Kind of Lady by Supertramp.
Okay.
Okay. Debuts there at 36. It doesn't crack the top 10 until the week of April 23rd, and it breaks into the top 10 at number 10. And then the next week, it jumps up to number 5, and it stayed there for 4 weeks.
Okay.
So that's where it peaked. And then 3 weeks after that, it was out of the top 40. Okay. So by, I guess that would be by the end of June. So had a nice little top 40 run between March and June.
What I thought was interesting is that it only reached number 49 in the UK. That it was
well, but if you do country. The conversion rate, that's like a number 27 song.
Well, because and I read an interview with him where he said that for some reason the most popular acts in Britain were the people who were he said the ones that weren't indigenous, that's the words that he'd use. He said where you had and I'm reading an interview he did with the AV Club, where he said Eric Clapton and the Stones were like blues music, and then you know the Police were reggae, and Malcolm McLaren had made African music, whereas he was the local who was just doing his own music, and so that's why it didn't quite catch on as quickly. And She Blinded Me with Science did hit number one in Canada.
Well, the Canadians are known for their science, for their science prowess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because like you mentioned earlier, there were 5 singles that came off this album. Mm-hmm. Do you...
Remember, these singles were... A lot of these had dropped in the UK before She Blinded Me with Science came out. Remember, because She Blinded Me with Science only appeared on the re-release of the album.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out, is where...
They were all released in July 81, August 81, January 82, March 82, July 82. Those were the ones from that album.
Okay.
Because the album itself had come out in March of 82. And then was re-released. It was released in the US in 82, and they changed a couple of the songs around. And then when it was re-released in 83, She Blinded Me with Science, a 5-minute extended version of the song, which is actually a little bit better, was the first track on the album. They had resequenced it or whatever. But it's been released several times. So it's kind of hard to tell, like you said, where does the single fit in with the rest of the album? Well, it wasn't really part of the album
first. Well, I was going to say, was there a follow-up single from this album? Or did it just go straight into the next album?
Well, what's interesting is, let me see if I can find it. He had, he put the single out, and he put out an EP called Blinded by Science. And there was She Blinded Me with Science, and there was another song on there called One of Our Submarines, which was released as a single. And then when they did when the album was re-released in America, both of those tracks were added to it. And so I don't believe that song, it didn't really chart much. But it was that would have been the next single that he came after She Blinded Me with Science.
Okay, yeah. So I was listening to Aliens Ate My Buick, which I thought was this follow-up, but no, it's not. And the one thing that struck me with that album, as opposed, same as Golden Age of Wireless, is, as we mentioned, these are not, I don't think these are albums that would be mainstream hits. They're not,
sure.
You know, it's not that they're bad music, they're just not popular music. Like, it's a very niche, some of the stuff on Aliens Ate My Buick kind of reminded me of a Brian Setzer type.
Oh, okay.
Guitar vibe, but...
Rockabilly.
Little, yeah. And I really hope that that is correct, because otherwise, I am bad at judging music. So if I'm totally off, somebody sitting at home listening to this being like, that is nothing like what I would have compared this music. Anyway, my point being that, as we've mentioned a few times here, is Thomas Dolby, I think in the terms of the one-hit wonder, is going to be a one-hit wonder because his music is not being made for the populace.
Yeah. He was more interested in, like you said, experimenting, trying to push the boundaries of what could be done with electronic music. And I don't think he cared necessarily about pop sensibilities. I think it was just like, it was kind of a byproduct of it.
Exactly. So I don't know if you how you want to run down the album. You know, we've mentioned a couple of songs. I as I mentioned earlier, this is an album that, for me, was very hard to separate one song from the other unless I focused 100% on the album and paid attention to when songs switch. So I don't have a lot of individual notes on songs.
Okay.
I don't know if you have anything that you want to touch on.
I only have a few because, like you said, I had the same problem where a lot of it did kind of blend together. I mean, the first song, Flying North, is a really good opening track. It kind of sets the tone for the whole album. I really liked, there was a song called Commercial Breakup, which was the second one, the second song on the album. And that kind of, that's also, that sort of, it just shows you, like, this is who Thomas Dolby is. It's got this kind of a neat sound. I really liked, it sounded a lot, it reminded me a lot of some of the stuff that, like, the Talking Heads or David Bowie were doing, where it's like some of the lines don't rhyme, you know, that was kind of, and that's, I think those two songs kind of, I could set the stage for the rest of the album, where what's funny is when you listen to that 2009 remastered version that we have, where She Bonded Me With Science is tacked on. It's sequenced with the 9 songs from the original release. And then when it goes into She Bonded Me With Science, it's track 10. It sounds totally different. Like it's a clear delineation between the previous songs that came before it. I mentioned before, Europa and the Pirate Twins was a song that was actually released as a single. It said it spent 5 weeks on the US charts. It peaked at number 67, but it also reached number 37 on the Billboard Rock chart. My favorite song, they said, was a song called Airwaves. Just light and airy. It's a really good ballad. I find interesting is that there's another song on here called Radio Silence. It was really catchy. You could tell it was built in like on a drum machine or, you know, on a synthesizer. And it's fully electronic, but when they re-released the album in the United States, they re-recorded the song as a guitar version. So it actually has a guitar riff instead. And that one's actually, it's a little bit better. But because it's not just the guitar, it seems like it's got a little bit more like a kind of a full sound to it. And like you said, and then One of Our Submarines, which wasn't really on the album, but that's a very catchy. I can see, you know, you can see why it was released as a single.
And I think looking forward to our in this discussion is the music itself in the album is not what is really fascinating. You know, the album is like we said, it's there. I'm not going to say it's a bad album. I'm not going to say it's a good album. It's an album that I can understand why people like it, but I think it's a very niche audience that will fully appreciate it.
Yeah.
What is more fascinating, in addition to what we've already said about how Thomas Dolby got started, is where Thomas Dolby went after this album.
Yeah.
And where he is now.
Yeah, I think the legacy of that album is probably just, if there was a good compilation album that came out, pull a couple of songs off there and then that would be it. I mean, I know listening to it from beginning to end, I'm not sure about that, but I will say that, you know, real quick, as far as the legacy of the song itself, I forgot to mention this. Mutt Lange actually does backing vocals on She Bonded Me With Science, yeah. And I found out that it appears on over 40 different compilation albums. I was surprised that I could only find one movie soundtrack that it appeared on, and it wasn't even the original soundtrack of Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion. It was the quote-unquote, more music from Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion soundtrack album. And then so at that point, he's hit his peak popularity. And the 2016 memoir that he wrote, he kind of reveals where he got to, where his career went off from there. What I find fascinating, and I'll try to, I can't tell the whole story, but I'll kind of summarize a little bit, was his relationship with Michael Jackson. Okay. Which I found was just absolutely fascinating, is that supposedly he was in England and he was in an editing room doing the sound mix for the She Blinded Me With Science music video, and Michael Jackson was next door and doing the music video for Billie Jean. Like, Thriller hadn't really become the big monster. Billie Jean was the first single, according to Thomas Dolby. I never did double check that. And he said he actually met Michael Jackson at the water cooler. They were both in the same studio at the same time, and they got to talking, and Michael had heard She Blinded Me With Science, and he loved it. And so he said, you know, if you're ever in Los Angeles, and he gave him his phone number, and he put it down, he said, Thomas said he put it in his Philofax. And so you know, cut to several months later, Shibayami with Science is like huge. He comes to Los Angeles. He plays at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. And after the show, Michael Jackson was there with an entourage of, he said 32 people. He said there were more people in Michael's entourage than there were in his entire stage crew and backing band. He said they'd already met earlier, and I guess there was also a moment when he first came over, he had gone to Michael's house and over in Encino, because it was when he came to America the first time, it was the only person that he only number that he had. And so they hung out at Michael's house in Encino, and they kind of just talked about music. So Michael came to his show at the Greek Theater, and they were just talking about like random electronic instruments. And I thought this was really funny. Michael said he was working on the Victory album with the Jacksons, which was the first album that he'd done after Thriller. And according to Michael, this is the quote that Thomas said. Michael said everything was chaotic. He said that each of his brothers wanted to get a song on the album because they knew that having one song on an album like that could mean a fortune to them. And so he said, according to Michael, all the songs that came in with all the demos were really lame. And so they were short. And he said, so Michael was dreading going back to the studio. And he said, do you have anything? He said specifically, you know, like that song Hyperactive that he had liked. And so... so he was like, "Well, I don't have anything. I got some demos that I'm working on. I can, but they're on my computer. I got to output them." And so he had a computer at the time. Thomas did. So he goes back to the tour bus that night. They're driving. They got a gig the next night in Salt Lake City. So they're driving all night in the tour bus. And so he has the bus driver pull over at a phone booth in the middle of the Nevada desert. And so he has with his computer, he has this device where you can put a cup over the mouthpiece on the phone and transferred stuff digitally through the phone. And so he's putting quarters into this payphone trying to transfer these demos to Michael Jackson in the studio, but it's not working. And the studio engineer can't figure it out. And so then Michael walks in, and so the engineer's like, "Hey, Michael, why don't you go on the phone with Thomas?" And so Michael says, "Why don't you play it old school, like just go play what you got, sing it for me." And so Thomas is like banging onto the playing percussion by hitting the payphone, and he's singing the song, even though he said it sounded a little bit like "Wanna Be Starting Something," but Michael said, you know "What else you got?" And then the second demo that he had, he said it was like a Prince power ballad, and he said Michael didn't like Prince, and he said according to Thomas Michael didn't approve of the quote "the purple one," and said that he was quote "too dirty." And so he didn't want to do that song. And so at that point, that was pretty much the end of the collaboration that they might have had. Prince, ironically, did show up to a Thomas Dolby gig at one point as well. But before I forget, too, I also have a note. I'm surprised we didn't mention that, his name. He's born Thomas Morgan Robertson. Hmm. And, of course, he gets the name Dolby because he was just tooling around with a lot of musical instruments and software, and his boarding school friends came up with the nickname. There was another musician named Tom Robinson in England who was starting to kind of get noticed. And so Tom Robertson would go to Tom Robinson gigs, and he said he went backstage at one of them, and they hit it off, and they made a deal, and they said whichever one hits it big, the other one changes their name. He said a couple months later, Tom Robinson had a hit in the UK, and so he became Thomas Dolby. He was sued by the Dolby Corporation. But then it took years of litigation, and the judge finally sided with Thomas and said, you can use the name, it's fine, it's just a person's name. After the success of Shibayami with Science, he created a collective called Dolby's Cube.
And this is what I find fascinating, is because of where Dolby's Cube kind of comes into the pop culture zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm. And it was created more for like dance-oriented music. He got to one of the people in Dolby's Cube was George Clinton, mm-hmm. and George Clinton worked with him on Aliens Ate My Buick, and so they did the soundtrack for a movie called Gothic, and they did another soundtrack for a movie called
Howard the Duck. I was going to ask you, who is the other person sometimes associated with Dolby's Cube?
Well, I mean, among many people, Leah Thompson was kind of involved with that, because I think there's performances in the movie.
Yes.
I don't know the movie very well.
Yeah, she plays the lead singer, guitar player of a female band.
And so those songs are essentially Thomas Dolby-produced songs with Dolby's Cube.
Tell 'em he ain't coming home. Now join the human race.
And from there, there was another lawsuit from Dolby, and this time Dolby won, and saying that they eventually prohibited him from using the name Dolby in conjunction with any other name than Thomas. Mm-hmm. That was the settlement up there. One of the things I found fascinating, and I hope you get a chance to see this, because whenever they put the clips up on YouTube, it gets taken down. At the 1985 Grammy Awards, he appeared as part of something called the Synthesizer Showdown. Herbie Hancock, Howard Jones, Thomas Dolby, and Stevie Wonder. All four of them are on stage, surrounded by a bunch of synthesizers. Howard Dolby's playing a guitar. Thomas is dressed like a composer, wearing a tuxedo and tails. So they start by doing, it goes around the room, and there's a computerized voice saying, "Introduce yourself." And then the guy says, "Herbie Hancock," and the crowd applauds. And then Howard Jones, Thomas Dolby, Stevie Wonder. They're just doing like a whole jam session mashup. They start by doing Rocket. Mm-hmm. And Herbie Hancock's huge hit at that point. Then they do She Blinded Me with Science. Then they do Howard Jones' song, What Is Love? Baby, Don't Hurt Me. No, not that's not. And then finally they end with a song called Go Home, which Stevie Wonder had been working on for a couple years, hadn't really released it as a single. When he did, it actually wound up being his last U.S. top 10 hit. And so the song ends with them doing a mashup of Stevie's Go Home with She Blinded Me with Science. And it's fascinating. It's so really, really neat. And like I said, thankfully someone finally, whenever the clip goes up on YouTube, the Recording Academy takes it down. And I was able to see it. Somebody left a copy up there. So he does that. And then after that, which is what I found the most fascinating, was he put together David Bowie's backing band for Live Aid, which was the summer of 85 at that point. His band was in America at the time, and David was filming Labyrinth in England. So he would film Labyrinth during the day and then rehearse with the band at night. And according to Thomas, they only rehearsed three nights. That's it. Two of the band members who were there had known Thomas for years, and so they'd been working with David, and so they suggested Thomas to David. Thomas put the whole band together. All the musicians were fans of Bowie's music from when they were younger, so they knew all the songs, so they could work on the songs while they waited for David to show up. They didn't know what set list they were going to do. David didn't even know what the concert was. He had a new single. He was just going to show up and sing his new single. And they said, no, it's like a charity concert. So they rehearsed five or six songs. They didn't know which ones they were going to do. And even when they showed up at the concert, David was just picking songs that they had never done the exact set list that they did until they got there. Like he said, literally, he said they took a helicopter over there because the traffic was so bad. They got a limo. They pull up at the stadium, and then as soon as they walk on stage, David's like, "Hey, we're starting with this song, go." I actually have the Live Aid concert on DVD. I was watching it before I came over to see it. I just had a curiosity. It's unfortunate because the camera positions are really weird, where Thomas is completely covered up. Like you only see him in a couple of shots. Even when they introduce the band and David says, "The great Thomas Dolby," and they don't know nothing, they don't really say anything. They only do four songs, and for having only done three rehearsals, they're incredibly tight. Like there's no screw ups. David's a consummate professional, and it's pretty fascinating. I found out later, I couldn't find anything more about it, but other than a picture, there's a picture of them on stage together, probably in the early 2000s. Like David's got longer hair. Thomas is playing a guitar. I don't know where that came from. So that was essentially I think that would have been one of the peaks of the 80s, because at that point, you know, he gets into like music, movie scores. He did Howard the Duck. He did three pieces for the soundtrack of Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest. I found that was interesting. He played the keyboards on a song called Circle in the Sand by Belinda Carlisle, which is one of her huge hits from the Heaven on Earth album.
Yes.
And then of course, then he gets into the 90s, and then he finds a completely new form of career involving software technology.
Well, I mean, you skipped over his co-starring role in one of the biggest films of 1990, a little movie not quite as good as The Apple, but a little movie with someone, an actor that is, you know, one of my personal faves from the late 80s, early 90s, Mr. Dean Cameron, a movie called Rockula.
Rockula, yes.
Where Thomas Dolby played a
pirate.
Was it a pirate?
A pirate with a peg leg, rhinestoned peg leg. But he was sort of the adversary, the antagonist to Dean Cameron's character. Have you seen Rockula?
I have started watching Dracula.
Okay.
Yeah, I have not been. I have not finished Dracula.
Nah, I don't blame you.
Yeah, it's an interesting film. It's Dean Cameron as a singing vampire with Bo Diddley as a backing guitarist, mm-hmm. and yeah.
I saw it. I was fortunate enough. I saw a screening of it at the New Beverly Theater here in Hollywood. It was a midnight screening.
Yeah,
I was. Dean Cameron was there.
I was out of town that weekend. I was very disappointed.
Yeah, Dean Cameron was there to introduce the movie, and he was obviously he's really funny. For those of you who don't know, Dean Cameron of course played
Chainsaw
in Summer School.
And if you don't know Dean Cameron, well, pause the podcast, go watch all those movies: Ski School, Men at Work,
yes.
Miracle Beach, and then come back to
Miracle
us and finish
Beach
the,
with Amy Dolan.
Amy
yes.
Dolan and Pat Morita. Yes.
Yes. Now, do you know who produced Rockula?
Was that Golden Globus?
No, Canon Films. Canon yes. Films. I don't know if Golden Globus. I don't think they got credits on it, but Canon Films did themselves. When I worked at MGM, I remember I remember seeing the title come across my desk from time to time. We didn't get a lot of orders for it, but
very underappreciated.
I went to that midnight screening and I fell asleep. I mean, it started a little bit late. It's kind of a boring movie. I totally forgot. I didn't realize Thomas Dolby. Tony Basil is also in the movie. Yeah. But Thomas Dolby's in it. What I found really fascinating, and I don't know if you know this, because Canon Films finally, or MGM recently, licensed the film to Shout Factory to put it on Blu-ray.
Okay.
That Blu-ray came out today.
Oh, wow.
As soon as you said Rockula, I was like, wait a minute. And I looked it up, and it was like, oh, it's on Amazon. And it said March 20th, 2018. I'm like, that's today's date. I thought maybe there was a glitch. And it's like, no. It literally came out on Blu-ray today. So,
well, see, there you go. You can, while you're listening to this podcast, you can jump over to Amazon on your computer or Amazon on your phone if you have the app and order Rockula, and you can probably have it by tomorrow.
Mm. Enter the promo code POSINCHAD.
And get no discount. In fact, Amazon will bar you from buying anything else in the future. No. But yes, after Rockula, as you started to say, Thomas Dolby then in the 90s, staying ahead of the curve, ahead of mm-hmm. the time, jumped into, like, I don't know if he started out doing cell phone work or if it just kind of evolved into that.
Yeah, like from what I gather, like I can't speak on it authoritatively because it's so fascinating. And from what I've been told, the memoir, the first half of the memoir is his music career, and the second half of the memoir is the post-music software stuff. He formed a company called Headspace, which was sort of the tech boom was getting going. He got it with venture capital money. And the idea was to develop sound engines for websites, so that when you went on a website, you could hear like a MIDI file or something playing. And so again, these things we take for granted, where he was figuring out like they had to try to make the file, they needed the music to be as small as possible so it wouldn't slow down the web page from loading. So that's what they were working on.
Is anyone who remembers AOL and the 1440, 14.4
slowly waiting
modems.
For the page to load, you know?
Yes, kids today in their high-speed internet have it so easy.
And so the company wound up kind of sinking into debt. And then he renamed it, or I think he formed another company with the same people called Beatnik, and that's the one that kind of took off because they sort of started getting into ringtones. And he said at one point two-thirds of all the cell phones sold worldwide were using Beatnik software. That's where he kind of got successful, because he said that with Headspace he was losing money. With Beatnik he still wasn't making any money. And then it wasn't until he formed a partnership with Nokia, because they said Nokia was a Finnish company and they wanted to sort of separate themselves from all the Japanese companies out there. And so they were working on the idea of having ringtones that came with their phones. And so they were looking at all these different, there was five or six different songs that Nokia wanted to have, you know, make a MIDI file version of this song to sort of be their signature tune or one of the ringtones that would be built into the phones. All the songs, except for one, had copyright issues. And so the song that they chose, the composer had been dead for more than 75 years, so therefore the copyright had lapsed. And that it was essentially, it was a waltz, and now it's known as the Nokia tune. Like they only chose that song because the guy had died, and they didn't have to worry about copyright. that lasted for a while, and Thomas kept doing, and so Thomas stays with the company for a while. Eventually, he goes to be the musical director for the TED Talks conference. He does that for 10 years. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, the Beatnik stuff goes away because once the smartphones figure out that you can actually use a WAV file as a ringtone, nobody needs the MIDI files anymore. And so I'm not sure if they said the company still exists or not in some form or fashion. But most recently, after he left the TED Talks, he became a professor of arts at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He helped them set up a film center and a new media music degree at the music conservatory there. The idea was they want to have students produce music for video games and virtual reality. He said he wants to use EEGs to help brainwaves control music. And what I thought was really interesting is because Johns Hopkins is known for being a medical university, what he'll be doing as a professor of the arts is he'll be collaborating with the medical campus and to help stroke victims recover using music, which I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, I saw an interview with him from, I believe it was around 2013, where they were talking video games and how he'd done some gaming, but he himself is not a big gamer, and he's disappointed that virtual reality, like in the 90s, did not take off and is not where, I guess, he thinks it should be now, where it's this immersive, you know, form. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he picks up, does anything more with that, or if he just lets the other people who want to do virtual reality do it while he continues teaching.
He's just, he seems like he's got his hands in so many different things. What I found so interesting about him, too, is that as compared to maybe some of the other one-hit wonders, mm-hmm. He doesn't mind. He's not ashamed. He doesn't, you know, listening to that Marc Maron podcast, and he asked him about, you know, do you not like playing the hits? He said, no, I love it. He's, you know, it's fascinating to watch. Like I said, when I first started going through the YouTube rabbit hole with him, one of the first clips I watched was a live performance of Shabani Mimi Science from 2016. Mm-hmm. And he's got a guy playing a guitar, another guy playing an electronic drum set, and then he's doing everything else. And he's just having fun with it. And then I saw another clip from a couple years prior to that, and he's doing the song pretty much all by himself. He's just, you know, he's got a bunch of synthesizers surrounding him. And then just last year, in April of 2017, he performed in the National Mall of Washington, D.C. for the March for Science on Earth Day. He played She Blinded Me with Science. Questlove introduced him. He's playing with a live band. Same thing. He's playing. The song can be played in a different fashion, so it doesn't get stale. You don't get complacent. And so he was joined on stage by Jon Batiste, Stephen Colbert's band leader, who did the solo part of the song using, I forget, is it vibraphone? The thing where he's like, he kind of, it's got, it looks like he's blowing into a plastic trumpet, but it's got like a keyboard on it. I forget what those are called. And so, but as an added bonus, he had all those clips recorded into his synthesizer. And so for the parts where the guys say science, or She Blinded Me with Science, he's got J.J. Abrams saying science. He's got Kerry Byron from Mythbusters. They used archival clips of Hillary Clinton and John F. Kennedy talking about science, and he's got them looped in. And he also has a loop from Buzz Aldrin, which you can talk about that one, but I finally watched that clip as well.
Yeah. When I was researching this, one of the first clips that came up on YouTube was, and I don't know what year it's from, but it was...
I think it's just last year.
Yeah, last year. Thomas Dolby and Buzz Aldrin doing Blinding Me with Science, where Buzz Aldrin basically was just there to shout out science every so often.
Thomas Dolby playing the whole song with one little synthesizer strapped just over his shoulder. Yeah.
So, I mean, it was interesting from a historical standpoint, I guess you could say, with seeing Buzz Aldrin out there, but you're probably not going to hear a clip on the show because it's really not that interesting as a audio cue.
If you like the song, it's just funny seeing that. Well, you always wonder if, like, what was Buzz Aldrin doing in the 80s? Like, he wasn't listening to Thomas Dolby. And so seeing the joy on his face, because, especially because he's like not on time and he's just shouting, science, or she blinded me with science. Yeah. And it's pretty fascinating, though.
And I was going to say, you were talking about, you know, getting stale and still doing the songs. As we record this, I believe within a day or two of the recording, Thomas Dolby is on the 80s cruise right now. Podcast that I listen to every Tuesday called Stuck in the 80s. They are, I don't know how they're involved with, if they are somehow put on the cruise or if they're just there because it's an 80s cruise. Mm-hmm. But they are, they've talked about hopefully interviewing him and will be on their podcast in the next couple of weeks. So Even if he isn't, check out Stuck in the 80s. I will pimp that podcast out because I am a child of the 80s and I love the 80s.
So. That's fascinating because, like I said, I think it was the Marc Maron interview where he specifically said he has no problem playing the old song, but he didn't want to do the rewind tour, as he called it. He said it makes you feel like you've peaked and you're only looking backward, and he always wanted to kind of look forward. And so he said otherwise, he said, I can go out with Spandau Ballet and Human League and all those people, but he seemed like he wanted to distance himself from that. But I guess maybe the cruise pays a little bit.
Yeah, maybe just want to go to the Bahamas and relax.
That's true. You know. Maybe his wife. Did you see who his wife is?
I did not.
His wife was an actress. Okay. She had a bit part in Godfather 2. She was a two year regular on Dynasty, and so I think they've got three kids together.
Yeah, I don't know why he's on the cruise, but I mean, Loverboy's there, Berlin. Maybe he's just a big Mike Reno fan.
That's true.
Maybe, you know, maybe they he probably. Can say,
you're the one that sang On the Loose, right? And he's like, no, no, that was Saga.
Oh, full circle. Anyway, that is pretty much a within an hour recap of the career of Thomas Dolby. Probably more information than you expected to hear about the man himself, less about the album. But again, we never know where these conversations are going to go once we start, as you said, down that rabbit hole of information.
Mm-hmm. Usually we end with the same kind of thought, too, which is, would you buy the album? Would you listen to other stuff? I mean, I'm very curious. Now that you've told me that Amazon has the other albums, I would actually be kind of curious to hear them. I don't know if I would. Would you buy the Golden Age of Wireless?
No, I don't think this is an album that I will throw on to listen to in the future. It's just, unless I'm looking for something just for background that I don't have to pay attention to. This is, again, not bad. It's not a bad album, just not my cup of tea.
I thought about it just because when I was reading into that 2009 reissue that comes with the live DVD and stuff, and then as soon as I found out that it's not available anywhere, and if you do find it, you have to pay through the nose. If I can find it at Amoeba Records here in Hollywood or something, maybe. But I mean, and what's interesting too is I would like to see if I can find the extended version of She Blinded Me With Science and just download that, because even the shorter version is the one that's on the album. So I'm sure you could probably, I'm guessing iTunes probably has the shorter version available, but it's just. And I jokingly say this, I'm getting married in a couple of weeks, and I would like to have this song on my wedding playlist just because it's so fun. It's been stuck in my head for the past week. Well, I've heard it so many times.
But your fiance is a scientist. So she kind of literally blinded you with science.
This is true. Maybe I hadn't thought about that. That's funny. I don't know. It's a funky song. Like, we did Safety Dance and we did the theme from Greatest American Hero, and those were fine songs, but this one, just like my dad always used to say, it puts a pep in your step, you know. It's more of an earworm than the other two songs we've done so far, I think.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Especially because I love that I've heard so many different versions and variations. I was telling you about, if you're listening to this at home, if you look up a cappella, there's an a cappella version that this guy who has a YouTube page, I think, or YouTube channel called A Cappella Science, and he basically recorded it live using an app on his iPad where he looped it all with a cappella sounds, and then he has Thomas Dolby singing with him. And just seeing the joy on Thomas's face where he's just like, he's hearing his music reinterpreted in a different fashion, and he's getting a kick out of it. And 35 years later, he still gets the joy out of that song, which is great, as compared to Joey Scarberry, who's just completely invisible. And this, every clip I've seen of the guys doing Safety Dance, they just seem like Ivan seems like he's kind of going through the motions, you know. He's just like, oh, that's that song I gotta do, I can't do any of my other stuff. Whereas Thomas is just like, hey, let's do Shemite with Science again, we love this song.
And I think, like you said, it's if you can mix it up to do it so you're not doing the same version over and over. And yes, unfortunately, a lot of these bands that are just out there doing the rewind tour because hey, it's an easy 5-song set, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, I went out as a result of this research and this podcast. I'm now following Thomas Dolby on Twitter just because I'm very curious to see if he'll ever do a. I'm not even sure if I would. Would you want to hear him in concert or a lecture? Because I think I'd be fascinated by either one. You know, the good thing is there's enough lecture clips on YouTube. I've seen a lot of interviews. I've heard some podcasts today that are fascinating interviews, and a lot of the podcast interviews were him promoting the book, so he's just telling stories from the book. But would you see him live in some capacity?
I would probably be more inclined to go to a lecture than the song, because as I said, the album, even live, I don't think this is an album that is for me.
Yeah.
Music for me.
I wonder if he would, but I wonder if he could do it, do both. Yeah. Like, I've seen, like, my favorite artist of all time is a woman named Kristen Hirsch. And I saw her, she wrote a memoir, and I saw her at the Getty Center Museum, where she was reading from the book and then playing songs the same, and then she would read an excerpt from the book and then she'd play a song. So that's, I think Thomas Dolby could probably do some sort of, I mean, he's doing a video game, or he did a documentary film and he scored the music for that. You know, I could see him doing some sort of multimedia experience, right? Where he would just be like, I'm gonna tell you about my life, I'm gonna tell you about my ringtones, I'm gonna give you a lecture about technology, I'm gonna drop in, here's Hyperactive, here's Airwaves, and then go back. I think he could put together like a cool, like a one man show, and he would literally be one musician if he didn't want to have a backing band.
And then he could sign a deal with Apple, and when you leave, you already have his ringtone installed on your phone and his new album.
There you go.
Yeah. All right, that is Thomas Dolby. That will wrap up this installment of Wonder Why. And now it is poll time.
Poll time.
Poll time. We should get a theme song.
That's got to be something.
Yeah. We, as we alluded to earlier in the show, after 3 months, 3 episodes of all 80s songs, we're going to take a break from the 80s. We're going to move into the 90s. We're giving you 3 choices to vote on. And I know these are, I know one band you have seen live in concert within the last year or two. Mm-hmm. The other ones, I don't know anything about them. And so that's kind of why we started doing this series is, you know, instead of picking even song bands that we are familiar with that may have been a one-hit wonder, like, for example, as we were discussing before we went on the air, Blind Melon, which, you know, have the albums, we listen to them, we're,
yeah,
you
know, I was good. A big fan of Blind Melon. I know they were a one-hit wonder, but I was listening to them heavily when they were out and got into them, yeah.
Right, I'd rather choose artists that I know nothing about and try to discover bands, so.
Wild Cherry, so close to Wild Cherry. D-Light, oh man. I need Kamozi.
I had all my Bewitched stories lined up for Play the Funky Music. I totally had to scrap everything that I had planned for this episode.
Oh, man.
Anyway, next month, your choices are, and you can go over to Twitter, at Chad Smart. I will post them there. I'm sure at Mike DeKalb will be retweeting them.
Sure.
And by the way, did I mention that we are on Twitter, at Chad Smart, at Mike DeKalb. Mm-hmm. Let us know what you think of this show. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Podcast, Stitcher. Leave a review.
Facebook page. Positive Cynicism.
Is Positive Cynicism. And we're all over social media. I mean, not technically because we don't actually do that much interaction. But if you write to us, we will write back. We will become pen pals.
Mm-hmm. Give us suggestions.
Yes.
As long as they're one. We may have to correct you if they have more than one hit. But yes.
Yeah. And anyway, the selections for next month are The Proclaimers. I'm going to be 500 miles. I would walk 500 miles, and I would walk 500 more. Just to be a man who walks 1,000 miles to fall down at your door. Hadaway, which was a suggestion a couple of people have submitted. What is love? What is love?
Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. No more. Baby, don't hurt me.
Yes. And the last one is Breakfast at Tiffany by Deep Blue Something. And I said, what about Breakfast at Tiffany? She said, I think I remember the film. And as I recall, I think we both kind of I remember hearing that song at a Walmart in like 1995 and going, what is that? And then the next time I was in Walmart, I heard it again. And then I heard it in the car on the drive home. And then I heard it on MTV the next day. So, yes, that's that one. But that's a pinnacle of a one-hit wonder. Yeah, I think I just heard the song in the last week, too, which is why it's on my brain. So, there you have it. The Proclaimers, Hadaway, or Deep Blue Something. Until we meet again and you're wondering why we can't do this more often. But once a month, I think, is enough. As always, do something positive. And question everything and wonder why. Radio.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.